I think Soderstrom is as exciting a hitting prospect as the A's have had since maybe Addison Russell. His feel for going the other way, his ability to both hit line drives and get enough power to go over the plate with it, his kind of pitch recognition skills, and he's only, you know, 18 and 19 years old, are all incredibly advanced.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Straight A's. Today I'm joined by The Athletic's Melissa Lockard. We discuss the impact of the A's lack of resources, Matt Olson and Matt Chapman's seasons, as well as the A's prospects to watch this year. With that, here's Melissa. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Straight A's. I am joined by Melissa Lockard of The Athletic. Thank you so much for joining me, Melissa.
Thanks for having me, Shana.
So I want to start off with some topics that are fresh on our mind, big league team questions, mostly to do with Marcus Semien because he's in town. He's right here now. We're going to see him with a new team. But I want to get back to something that he said a few months ago. And I don't know if you've seen this or not, but we can discuss just the premise of it. He said to some Blue Jays reporters that he was impressed by the amount of resources that the Blue Jays had. And I think what the reporters were saying is that he was impressed by the dietitians, some of the tech, some of the coaches. And I'm wondering, the reason why that stood out to me is because, and we're just going to dive right in, I think that that might be something that is not talked about a lot when it comes to the A's and their development and their analytics staff and coaching staff. And I know a while ago you did a piece on how they have a 5-person analytics team. And I'm wondering what you think about the advantages of having that. And maybe if you think that maybe a place where they could catch up with the rest of the league is by bolstering their staff.
Absolutely. You know, and it's funny because since that 5-person staff article came out, of course, Dan Kantrovich is no longer with the organization and he was, you know, the head of that group. So it's probably even smaller now, technically. I think from a data perspective, you know, part of why they have a leaner staff is because all of their upper level guys, you know, like David Forrest and Dan Feinstein come from an analytics background. So, you know, they can handle a little more of the, I don't know, numbers crunching is the exact right word, but like, you know, some of that stuff that maybe you would, in other organizations, the top people would sort of be pushing down to the lower level, they can kind of actually do some of that themselves, you know, which does streamline things. And of course, it puts a ton on the people at the top, which, you know, has advantages and disadvantages. You know, but that's sort of how it's been structured a little bit. But there's no question that from a back-end resources perspective, you know, that's where the A's budget shortfall, I think, is more acutely felt than maybe even in their big league roster. Because I think they've shown they've been able to manage winning with a very lean, you know, big league salaries, but almost all of their financial resources goes towards that big league salary. They don't have a ton of extra money left over after that, just based on how ownership has sort of given them that money. So, you know, they have added some different layers to their player development staff over the last few years in terms of pitching performance stuff. They brought in a ton of technology, and Ed Sprague, who's now the director of player development, you know, actually sort of started really moving up the farm system, leadership from that perspective, because he sort of took ownership of this, bringing in the technology, Pac-Man and Rob Soto and all these different tools. And he's built that out quite a bit. But that being said, you look at the staff lists for the A's in player development, you look at the staff lists even on the major league coaching staff, and compare them to even the Giants across the Bay,
right?
It's just significantly smaller. So, you know, there, most of the people that work for the A's have worked for the A's for a really long time. And so they're kind of used to working in a very lean environment, and they sort of are willing to jump in and handle a bunch of different roles, and they're good at what they do. So I think they've been able to kind of stay afloat because of that. But I'm sure in an ideal world, if they had more resources to bring in more people, you'd find a lot more efficiencies. And certainly for players now, with the amount of data that they can play with, the amount of information, the amount of toys they can use to get better.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, having these extra coaches and player development staff on hand to be able to give them time to work with that stuff. Even Oculus, you know, they were raving on and on about being able to use those Oculus devices for seeing pitchers they hadn't seen before. And, you know, teams had had that for maybe 1 or 2 years before the A's got it. You know, now they do have it and they're making great use of it. But that is certainly, I think, where they've had to kind of compete a little bit behind some of these organizations like the Blue Jays that do have really robust resources at their disposal. Yeah.
Right. And not to compare too much with the Giants, because I know that A's fans get touchy about that. But it just from a outsider's perspective, it seems like a lot changed when Farhan Zaidi came in and just brought a lot of coaches in. Like, he just everyone was sort of making fun of, like, oh my God, there's 20 plus coaches here. Who are these people? They're all young. Who are these guys and girls? But it seems like a lot changed. Like, you can look at Evan Longoria and his transformation at the plate. I just, like, from a tangential perspective, seems like it has a lot to do with a shift in coaching. So I'm wondering if they're even just looking at the Giants, how much some cohesion in development and coaching has to do with what we're seeing in some of the veteran players on that team.
Yeah. I mean, I think I actually spoke with somebody that is in the Giants organization now that used to work for the A's, you know, and he said that basically what Farhan has done is created the A's model and given it like a huge money boost, right? Like giving resources behind it, but it's very much built in what, you know, Billy Beane and David Forrest have, you know, sort of created over the last 25 or so years. So that's sort of the backbone of it, the ideas of it, the being creative, the looking for small areas where you can focus on in order to really exploit something that, you know, looks like maybe other teams hadn't done that yet. But, you know, that is very much where they're at. You know, being able to be versatile with their rosters, having good depth, all that stuff is sort of based in, you know, those ideals that I think were obviously have been ingrained in the A's way of doing things for a very long time. Right. They have a lot of money to work with. And where they can staff up, they've staffed up considerably. And I'm not sure from a major league coaching standpoint, if that was more Gabe Kapler or Farhan Zaidi, but certainly the minor league reorganization from their player development staff, a lot of that happened even before Gabe came on board. And I think some of those positions that you see, the additional coaches on each staff and stuff is, you know, certainly something that if they had the resources, I'm sure, you know, the A's player development staff would love to have.
Yeah, exactly. It all boils down to resources with them. Like, I think that when it comes to ownership and money, a lot of people focus on they're not signing the big free agents. They're not spending a lot of money on very specific players. But I think it also could be said that, or it might be fair to say that a allocation of resources to sort of streamlining all the analytics system or process that the A's have and have had and are at the forefront of could maybe benefit them in the same way that it's benefiting someone like the Rays or the Giants or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, like teams have to sort of pick and choose where their focuses are. And like for the Rays, for instance, you'll notice like they don't hold on to their guys till their seventh year, even the way that the A's do at the big league level. They tend to turn guys through the first 3 years and then they pull them out. But they put a ton of their resources towards player development and international free agent signing. Whereas the A's focus is a little bit more traditional in terms of a draft and free agent signing and development. And then they do try to keep their guys at least until free agency or at least until that fifth or sixth year where things get really expensive. And they do bring in more veteran kind of stopgap guys than I think the Rays do. It's a different style. You know, I thought that series recently was kind of interesting because, I mean, it was such a well-played four-game series. And they aren't necessarily similar teams, but they're similarly creative in how they built these teams. And I think, you know, when you have $100, like how you spend that $100 is going to be chopped up in a bunch of different ways. And, you know, I think when you look at the A's and the Rays, they chop it up very differently, but the end result has been pretty similar.
Yeah, I think everyone wants to say the Rays and A's are the same because of they're both low budget, low payroll teams. But see, there's a lot of big differences that you notice in how they churn their rosters. It's actually, they're pretty different. And I think that they might say that too, if they could.
Even just the way they handle their pitching staff, you know, like I remember Bob Melvin said something in one of the pregame, media availabilities about that's just how they do things in terms of just not expecting the starters to go 5 or 6 innings.
Right.
And obviously that's just not how the A's have approached their starting.
Yeah. The A's are pretty traditional when it comes to on the field action and coaching and everything. I think Scott Emerson, the pitching coach, is a good example of how they are traditional, but also incorporate the information, the new information they're getting, the TrackMan information they're getting. the analytical information they're getting. I think that the coaching staff seems to be very embracing what they're getting, but they're also very traditional in how they employ the players and how they deploy the players.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like his line about pitch design. He's like, well, we've been designing pitches for years, but I guess we're doubting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, yeah, exactly. Or tunneling is, you know, he's like, sure, if you want to call it tunneling. I mean, I've been calling it tree bashing since the 80s. Right. So, you know, yeah, well, I'll take this new information. This is great. But like, this is not a new concept to me.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Pitching backwards, all those different things. Things that have been talked about for a long time with just different terminology, for sure.
Exactly. It's pretty fascinating to talk to the coaches. I want to transition to Matt Olson. Just because he's having black eye aside, he's having a pretty consistent year. I don't know if you could say anything is consistent when we've gone 1 month into the season, but this is just maybe only observational, but it seems like, and he sort of confirmed it a little bit when we were able to talk to him, but it seems like he's taking a more contact-based approach at the plate. Obviously, he's still going to swing for the fences, but it seems like he's doing a little bit more with pitches, you know, low and away, with breaking stuff. He's able to go the other way and beat the shift, but also, you know, he said that he is inspired by Jed Lowry and his approach at the plate. What do you think about what you've seen from Matt Olson?
I think he got a little, I think last season was so weird that every hitter kind of got into, you know, maybe a kind of a, not rut would be the wrong word, but like some sort of a focus that was just singular because they couldn't do all the things that they normally do to prepare and they had such a short period of time. But I think, you know, it was pretty clear he was home run focused, you know, last season, or at least the results were that way. And so it was going to be kind of home run or nothing. And obviously, he always takes a lot of pitches. He sees the ball really well. He's a tough at bat no matter what. But there was that very pull heavy approach. And he's a pull hitter. And that's, you know, I think part of what, when he was struggling in AAA, they sort of had to say to him, was like, listen, they're going to shift you. You can't change who you are just because they're shifted so far to that side. You know, but if you do start to think a little bit middle of the field, it may just change it enough that it'll loosen up that shift a little bit. And I remember in that breakthrough season that he had, that finally in AAA where things kind of came together for him, and then he eventually came up and had that really hot end to the 2017 season, really, you know, secured his spot with the A's. It was more of that up the middle approach that got him, you know, kind of away from worrying so much about the fact that they were stacking the infield so far towards right field. And so, and Eric Martins was his hitting coach, you know, at that time, obviously with Nashville. And I think there's probably a mentality there that when you were able to slow it down this season, you know, you had an off season to prepare, you had spring training that was more normal. It wasn't this weird interrupted thing and then a rush to the start of the regular season. If they could kind of go back to, you know, let's think about like what made you such a successful hitter. Because I do think he can be a much more well-rounded hitter than maybe, you know, what he had gotten pegged to be. I don't think he's necessarily has to be a three true outcomes guy. I think he can be a guy that gets a lot of other hits along the way. I don't know that 330 is sustainable, you know, as a batting average, but, you know, I don't see why he couldn't be a guy that hits 270, 280 every year, because he does see the ball so well. And he does have such a, you know, quick, you know, kind of from, you know, the load of the bat to getting the ball, bat on the ball, you know, it's not like it takes him a long time to get there. So he should be able to make a pretty decent amount of contact. I mean, I think, you know, he's also at that stage of his career where it's like, he's no longer young in terms of experience. He kind of knows himself as a hitter. And I think that's when players who become, you know, really special players tend to take off. And we may be sort of seeing him really evolve into who Matt Olson is going to be, you know, moving forward in his career.
I think that's why it's been so exciting to see his start so far, is because, you know, you go into the season like, this is the year for Matt Chapman and Matt Olson. You know, they've been here long enough. They're nearing their peak, and you want to see them become more self-actualized, evolved hitters. And Matt Olson looks like he's becoming, you know, who we thought he was at the plate. And last year was such a weird year. You could see that he sort of felt the pressure to create runs as quickly as he could, like, you know, okay, I'm in the middle of the order, I'm a home run, I'm a slugger, I can get a home run with one swing, so I'm going to do that. And you could see that sort of catching up in his head. And when the mechanics weren't right, then it just spiraled a little bit. So this year, now that maybe he has a little more mental clarity and space to be himself, we're starting to see the real Matt Olson, which is, I guess, should be exciting for A's fans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think he's a guy that, like, you kind of remember, you know, back when Jason Giambi was sort of developing into who he became, like, at the start of his career, you know, he wasn't necessarily as well-rounded a hitter as he became when he got to that peak of the, you know, the MVP season and the season he should have been the MVP. But, you know, like, that there was an evolution in understanding how he could really impact not just hitting home runs, but really being an all-around hitter. And a lot of the skill sets that Matt Olson brings to the plate are very similar to what Jason Giambi brought to the plate. And I'm not saying he's going to be, I mean, you know, Jason Giambi is one of the greatest A's hitters that ever, you know, played, but I certainly think Matt Olson can have a long sustained career where you think of him as one of the top hitting first basemen in the league for a long time.
He has the tools.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure. What about, I brought up Chapman. What do you think about what he's been going through over the last few years? I feel like the last time I saw him, and I won't count last year because I think that he was just hurting the entire time. Last time I feel like he was really in a groove at the plate was August 2019 before he got hit in the head in Kansas City. And after he got hit in the head, everything just spiraled for him. And, you know, he had the hip issue last year. What do you see that's up with him at the plate and that sort of contributed to his continual, I don't know if it's continual slump, but his inability to get over the hump?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, I mean, like last season, as bad as everything kind of seemed at times for him, and obviously the finish right before he went on the injury list with the hip injury, I mean, I don't remember what it was, like 18 strikeouts and 19 at bats or some crazy thing that sort of, you know, created some weird splits for him. But even his overall numbers were still pretty good despite that. Like, I think he's streaky. So and not to bring back all the old A's because I know that's tiresome, but like, it's sort of like Eric Chavez was, where you would sort of watch a full season and there'd be like huge chunks of it where you're like, God, this guy can't hit. Like, what's the deal? You know? Yeah. And then you come to the end of the year and you're like, wow, he was one of the best third basemen offensively in the league. So, I mean, in some ways I think, you know, because Matt Chapman does have a lot of swing and miss in this game, he does tend to be a little bit streaky. You know, that year in Double A when he won the Texas League Most Valuable Player, it was like that, where the overall numbers were really good despite the fact the strikeouts were really high. And there were a number of games where he might have been like 2 for 5 with 3 strikeouts and, you know, 2 home runs or something. And that's just, I think, going to be part of his game. And I don't know that that's ever necessarily going to change. That being said, though, he has the capability of still managing to hit, you know, for a pretty good average, even with all that swing and miss.
Right.
Not necessarily, again, 300, but I think you see a guy who can hit like 270 to 290 despite a lot of strikeouts. So it's kind of an interesting package. I do think, you know, one of the things that was really interesting was that, you know, early in the season, I think he was going to left field a lot. Like, he was definitely pulling the ball a lot, and that's not really his game. And so when he did have those 2 hits to right center the other day, you know, the home run and another double, and I think that's when you start to think, okay, maybe he is able now to have his legs under him and really get to where he is, because his power is really to right center, even though he's a right-handed hitter. So I think that's a good sign. And you know, it is going to be tough this season. I think historically, if you look at guys that have that hip labrum surgery, their first season back offensively is not great. You look at Buster Posey is one example.
Right.
I think we'll probably look at Aramis Garcia and sort of see whether that's going to be impacting him as well, because he had that surgery. And you know, Chapman's not a catcher like those other two, but there is certainly a lot that the legs have to do in order to make you effective as a hitter. But if he is now able to kind of keep that front shoulder in, go towards right center and be more on the baseball than he was before, I think we'll probably start to see better results from him. But if this season things are a little bit down offensively, it wouldn't be shocking, just given the short turnaround from the injury, and that maybe next season is when he's able to get back to, you know, who he was in 2019.
Yeah, it's when he's had his best games, it's been when he's been able to make contact through right center, when he's, you know, hitting the other way a little bit, or, you know, he's when he puts together a good at bat, that seems like that's the end result, and that's when he's most pleased with his results, is not when he's necessarily pulling the ball, but when he's getting good power slightly the other way or up the middle.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's a timing thing too, like, you know, because if he's flying, you know, if he's pulling the ball, he's sort of flying out ahead, and then maybe at that point, you know, he's not able to sort of make the adjustments when it's not necessarily where he thought the ball was going to be. But when he's kind of able to stay, you know, with his shoulder in and kind of directed towards right center, he can wait a little bit longer on it.
Yeah.
He can make contact later in, you know, in the kind of pitch plane or whatever that is toward. And so, and because he's strong enough, waiting that little bit doesn't rob himself of the power. So, I think that is where you start to see maybe when the strikeouts do go down a little bit, is that he's not having to guess early and try to pull. You know, he can trust that his strength is enough that he can still wait and go towards right center.
It certainly hasn't impacted his defense. He looks exactly the same after the hip surgery.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, you know, there's probably was a little bit of rustiness at the beginning, you know, especially like spring training or whatever. But he's, you know, he works really hard. Like, he's a guy that I don't know that people necessarily realize how much he puts into, you know, his preparation and everything. But you would never expect him not to be super prepared for the season. And that's, you know, certainly like, you know, where he's at there. And so physically, if he was going to be able to be there, he would expect him to sort of be at his best, you know.
What sort of a common theme, we're talking about Matt Olson and what he was doing last year. I was asked yesterday on with Vince Catroni, I went on the radio with him. He asked me, what does baseball need to do to get away from the three true outcome situation? And for some reason, like, I know that this is an issue in baseball. I know that it's a topic of discussion, but for some reason, my answer was, I don't think it's a big issue right now. I'm enjoying the art of the strikeout. I'm enjoying sort of watching everyone sort of master this new phase in baseball. But I was thinking about it and I was like, well, I don't know if that's an acceptable answer. I don't know if that's what we want in terms of watchability. I don't know if normal people are into that. And I guess that sort of raised the question for me, what is the solution to making baseball less three true outcome-y? And is it just banning the shift?
Right. I mean, I think it's hard because, you know, it works, right?
Yeah.
And if something works, teams aren't going to kind of shy away from it. And it's hard to tell people not to do something that's successful.
Right.
One thing I really thought, though, on the Sunday game, the aggressive base running that the A's did, getting those couple of extra runs, it not only made the difference in the game, but it also was really fun to watch. And that isn't something that has been part of their game in a very long time. And I do wonder if, because the games have been lower scoring in April, if that is something that has kind of incentivized teams like the A's to be more aggressive with their base running, because they've talked about it for, you know, every spring training. Oh yeah, we're going to run more. Oh yeah, we're going on base running first and third. You know, they've been drafting better athletes and developing those kinds of players that can do things like Matt Chapman is able to do on the bases, and Mark Canha, you know, bringing him in the Rule 5 draft and Laureano. But they haven't really given them the green light to be those kind of players. And the fact that you're seeing that now more could be because so many of these games are so close-knit that every run really does matter. And it does make it more, it does sort of incentivize teams to take risks to score runs because you need to get that one or two run. You can't wait around for the three-run homer. And I know Laureano's mentioned that he thinks the ball's not traveling as much. And so if you can't count on that three-run homer at the end of the game, you know, maybe having Marcotte, you know, wave somebody in at the third on a slightly wild throw is the way you need to go. And I think that is a great product. I mean, there's a reason that Ricky Henderson is, I think, probably everyone's favorite player, is because not only was he walking all the time and hitting home runs and stuff, but every time he got on base, it was a total show. And nobody can be Ricky Henderson, but I think you can kind of have more of that in the game. So figuring out ways, I think, to make base running important again, you know, might allow for a lot of this. I don't even know if the shift needs to necessarily go away. But, you know, the fact that the shift is there should make it easier for teams to steal bases.
And should make it easier. Second, they just go.
Yeah, and you know, fielders don't necessarily make good cutoff throws from those spots because it's a weird place and they haven't grown up their whole lives doing it. So, you know, maybe that's where we start to see it. And I think you start to see those highlights on SportsCenter again, and you know, and then kind of younger kids casually start, oh, wow, look at, did you see Laureano's crazy catch and then him slide through, you know, head first to score on a ball that just went away. I mean, that's cool. Scoring on a ball hit to the shortstop from second base is, like, I think one of the neatest sports things you can look at, right? Like,
right.
So maybe that's where we can get the game going more again. and maybe less focus on worrying about, you're right, because I think it is cool to see a 96 mile per hour splitter. You know, like, there's no reason.
I don't know how we can go back on that. Right? Like, no, you can't strike these guys out.
Right.
Don't throw hard.
Exactly. Sorry that your cut fastball is now faster than every recorded fastball from 1991, you know, or something.
That's so, well and nice, but you're ruining the game a little bit. Right? So let's tone it down a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think those things are fine. I think baseball as a skilled sport is as high as it's ever been in the history of the game. These guys can do things that are, you know, just jaw-dropping. Yeah. But the base running is the one thing that I think has fallen off in recent years. And the more that action that can happen because guys are being aggressive on the bases, I think the more fun the games will be. And then, you know, so maybe, you know, I don't know that there's a rule change necessarily that has to happen on that, but it just anecdotally, it does seem like with the lower scoring games, the base running has been a lot more interesting so far this season.
Yeah, that's a good point that I hadn't thought of, because my general idea is that any rule changes that curb advancement in the game just doesn't feel right. Like, have someone figure out what the next thing, like, you know, keep it going. Don't try to hold it back with rules and arbitrary rules that maybe don't even do anything. And banning the shift just seems like, you know, you're stopping something that a team or the league has advanced on or discovered, or, you know, you do the next step. Like, you know, let the teams figure out how to combat a disadvantage that they're seeing now. I think that that's my general stance. I don't know if that's super accurate.
What if the NBA had been like, you know what, we're not such a huge fan of like Splash Brothers, so like we're not going to allow 3-point
exactly shooting. Basketball's
or you're not allowed to shoot it within like past, you know, 38 feet or something.
Right, you know, like Steph Curry changed the entire game because he was like, I don't see why you guys are not shooting threes all the time, it's an extra point. So I'm going to do that. And then everyone adjusted accordingly. They weren't like, now this is ruining. And I don't know, defenses, the defensive rules have also come into play there in basketball. We don't have to go on a basketball rant, but you know, they're not changing anything to go backwards on how the game is revolutionized, which is not like baseball should either.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Okay, I want to get to prospects stuff, because we saw all the rosters and I looked at all of them, and now I kind of like, it's all jumbled in my head because there's so many names. Were there any surprises for you in terms of where any of the players were located?
Not too surprising. I think, you know, the A's that were kind of in the middle road in terms of, I think, being aggressive and conservative with their placements. I think we saw some aggressive assignments in looking at like Logan Davidson and Kyle McCann going from Double A, where their only previous, you know, professional experience was short season. I think both those guys coming from, you know, power conference collegiate backgrounds and having been in big league camp and all that, you know, will be able to handle it. But those are certainly aggressive assignments, and, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing how they're gonna do there. But, you know, then you look at like Austin Beck, who struggled in high A in 2019, and they're having him repeat in high A rather than just saying, okay, just because you're a year older now, we're going to go ahead and push you up to Double A. And I think that's fine too. You know, he's still a young hitter, and there's certain things that need to click for him. You know, let him click in an environment that he can be successful, and then move up to the things that are going to challenge him about upper level pitching. I think it was kind of, it's going to be interesting. And I know a lot of the farm directors are sort of struggling with how do you assign your players, because the leagues themselves have changed so significantly. The fact that there is a full year of development that didn't happen. And so, you know, you can't assume just because someone got physically a year older that they are developmentally a year older than they were in terms of their game. So I imagine that the first month or so, there's going to be just a lot of observations, correct, you know, throughout all of minor league baseball to kind of see how guys are stacking up, what the level of play is in this version of Double A as opposed to the version of Double A we saw in 2019 and so forth. And then you might start to see some shifting, but I don't think teams are going to be like rushing to move guys. I think they'll take a little bit of time, let everybody sort of settle in, get their feet under them, get their, like, you know, game speed back, because they really only got a couple of weeks of minor league spring training games. It's not like they've been playing a big schedule up till now. And then, you know, maybe come late June, you'll start to see, you know, more of the prospects moving around a little bit. But I think Stockton, you know, first season in low A, and I'm sure the fans were a little bit disappointed in that market not to be at the high A level anymore, but they're getting, you know, outstanding rosters.
So yeah, it's going to be fun to watch.
Yeah, Tyler Soderstrom, got Robert Lawson. You even got Lazarito back, you know, if they want to see him again.
He's been an enigma.
But Brian Bulbis is another one who's, you know, going to be a really fun prospect to watch. And then, you know, so you've got some really interesting kind of high upside talent there. And then, you know, you've got that high A team in Lansing. You've got some of the guys that they picked in draft last season, and Jeff Criswell and Michael Goldberg, and Stevie Emanuels. So that's some guys making their pro debuts at high A, which is certainly going to be a challenge, I think, you know, for those guys. But, you know, again, it's going to be interesting to see whether that league, which used to be the low A Midwest league, plays more like low A or plays more like high A. It's going to be a little bit of a jumble around there to sort of see how that all works out. Because obviously the environments with the ballparks, the weather and everything else is dramatically different than the California league was. So it's going to be a lot of kind of experimentation. It could be 2 years before people really have a good understanding of like how the levels are going to play out. And maybe even what the impact was of losing a full season of development on these players. But at the same time, I think, you know, everyone is just so happy that guys are going to be back out there playing again, that there's going to be actual, you know, ways to sort of see if any of this work they did in batting cages and labs and on the back of their, you know, in the house, throwing baseballs on their garage or whatever it was they were able to do during the shutdown, like, you know, what was any of that? Was there progress made? Was there not? You know, and we'll sort of be able to see. So it's going to be a fascinating year, I think.
I mean, I've only seen some of the prospects in spring camp, and I was totally impressed with Soderstrom just at the plate, the fact that he's coming off high school and was able to hit some big league pitching just out the gate. What do you think? And also with Logan Davidson, he looked, apparently he gained some muscle, he gained some strength, and it showed immediately at the plate. What do you think about those two in particular in terms of if they're going to be fast-tracked, kind of? I know it's been, who knows what the missed season is going to, how it's going to impact all the prospects or the process. But what do you think about those two in particular, or who else might be on the faster track to the big leagues?
Yeah, I mean, I think with Soderstrom coming right out of high school, I don't think there's going to be any rush to move him. But, you know, I think I would sort of equate his season, this season in low A, with how, you know, Matt Olson, Daniel Robertson kind of came and went right to full season ball in their first full professional seasons coming out of high school. They stayed in that low A for most of that season. Got a little bit of taste of advanced level play at the end of the season and the postseason there, and then, you know, we're on their way. But those first couple of years can be really huge building blocks for moving forward, and I think they don't want to rush those necessarily. You know, that being said, and I could be, you know, talking like hyping up too much, but I think Soderstrom is as exciting a hitting prospect as the A's have had since maybe Addison Russell. You know, and just the his feel for going the other way, his ability to both hit line drives and get enough power to go over the plate with it, his kind of plate pitch recognition skills, and he's only, you know, 18 and 19 years old, are all incredibly advanced. And then, you know, you look at behind the plate, he was really raw. And when he came into the alternate site last summer, and the advancement that he's made just from alternate site work and big league camp as a catcher is also really impressive. And even if ultimately he doesn't end up a catcher forever, that just shows an aptitude for sort of being able to pick up things that I think is going to be really, you know, kind of impressive. And it's, you know, it's sort of like Chad Pinder, like what makes him so valuable is he can basically be told to do anything and he can go out and do it. And, you know, that's pretty rare. And so when you kind of combine that ability with this just innate hitting ability that Soderstrom seems to have, I mean, I think he's got a chance to be a really, really special player. And, you know, Davidson had, I think he would have been a more hyped prospect, but he had a rough month with Vermont when he, you know, signed as a first round pick, and people kind of, you know, kind of looked a lot at those numbers and sort of dismissed them, which would seem sort of silly. I mean, it was like a debut season and a month in the tough hitters league.
A few games.
And so, but he sees a ton of pitches, you know, switch hitter, great athlete, power from both sides. There is swing and miss there, and I think that'll always be there. But I think, you know, he has a chance to be kind of a similar player to Jed Lowrie, but with a little more power and a little more strikeouts. And he can play all over the infield. You know, he's not Nick Allen in terms of his ability at shortstop, but he's still average to above average there. And he can play third and he can play second. And you could probably play the outfield if you asked him to as well. So he's going to be one of those valuable guys. He also runs really well. You know, he's a guy that could probably get double digit steals for you pretty easily to go along with the power. So those combination of tools are pretty unusual. And, you know, he was a guy that early in his junior season at Clemson, there was this idea that he might go in the top 10. And then he struck out a lot. Scouts sort of got a little leery and he fell to the A's at that part of the first round. But they were thrilled to get that kind of talent and where they got him in the first round. I think you can see why when he's out there playing. Double A will be a tough assignment. The Texas League is not, well, or whatever they're calling it now, Double A.
The old Texas League, yeah, whatever it is.
But it's not an easy place to hit,
especially
Midland. You know, they've got some winds there that really knock a lot of balls down. It can be a tough travel league, although I think it's with these 6-game series and one travel day a week is going to be a little bit easier for players to deal with those travels, you know, in the past. But I still think he's going to be a really one of those prospects that people didn't pay as much attention to. And then all of a sudden they're talking about like, wow, this guy, you know, a little like Matt Chapman was. It's like everyone in the A's were very excited about him. And then all of a sudden the rest of the league was like, oh yeah, there's this Matt Chapman guy, you know?
Right.
So I think in a year or so, you know, he's going to be a guy that they're going to be wondering, you know, where should we fit him in the infield?
Well, it's hard not to get excited about those guys, especially Tyler after seeing him at the plate. Thank you so much for joining. We'll cut it off there. I could go on and on. I just want to know about everybody, but we can't go through the entire, every single minor league roster, but maybe another time. Cause I feel like there's so many guys that we didn't touch on that I'd love to know more about. So thank you so much for joining and for sharing your immense expertise on everything.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. This was fun.
Thank you all for tuning in. Thank you to Melissa Lockard for joining the show. You can follow my A's coverage all season long at San Jose Mercury News and on Twitter at Shayna Rubin. Till next time.